唱歌，我就把
that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
If man is the father, the sun is the center of the earth, in the middle of the universe, then why is this verse coming 6 times rehearsed? Don't freestyle much, but I write them like such.
Word.
Amongst the fiends controlled by the screens, what does it all mean, all this I'm seeing? Human beings screaming vocal javelins, sign of a local unraveling.
Uh-huh.
My wandering got my wondering, where Christ is in all this crisis. Hating Satan never knew what nice is. Check the papers, well I bet on ISIS. More than your eye can see and ears can hear. Year by year all the sense disappears. Nonsense perseveres, prayers laced with fear. Beware, 2 triple O.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game if it ain't saying nothing.
Damn, was it something I said? Pretend you don't see, so you turn your head. Race scared of his shadow, does it matter? Thought of reparations, got a plan with the population. Nothing to lose, everything's approved.
people use, even murder's excuse. White men in suits don't have to jump. Still 1,001 ways to lose with the shoes. God takes care of old folks and fools, while the devil takes care of making all the rules. Folks don't even own themselves, paying mental rent to corporate presidents. 1 out of 1 million residents be a dissident who ain't kissing it. The politics are chains and whips, got the sick missing chips and all the championships. What's love got to do with what you got? Don't let a win get to your head or a loss to your heart. Nonsense perseveres, prayers laced with fear. Beware, 2 triple O is near.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, behind the game. I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game if it ain't saying nothing.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware. It's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Thought of that millennium just be killing them. That's scary, like lies buried in a library. When did a state pen correct anything? When piles of us still be catching the bus. When stacks of cats packing laundry mats. Pay the preachers back, but where the teachers at? I ain't even gotta ask it. And who's underpaid that got fouled at the basket? I can't blame the envy at who be getting all the Benjis and taking them grants for granted. Last I checked, pyramids wasn't built like projects or in them government checks. Modern day thugs ain't got no guts. Pardon the expression under governor nuts. Last time in the church be the last time in the church. Dead pledged allegiance to CDs and movies. Leaving reality, believing fantasy. Bleeding fatalities, too many formalities. Prayers laced with fear, beware. 2 triple 0 is here.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, behind the game. I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but the game if it ain't saying nothing.
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, good evening and welcome to another Tuesday night here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We really appreciate all of you and your presence here tonight. We are going to be embarking upon a dynamic conversation dealing with our history and the tradition that the Black Reality Think Tank presents. So we're so happy that you're here. Always pleased that you can join us here each Tuesday. I hope that you have had a wonderful and productive week since we were here last Tuesday, for those of you who joined us last Tuesday. And that has been very, very productive. We are broadcasting here in a temporary studio situation here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We'll be going back to our home base very shortly, but we're just here now doing some things that we need to do, our family and things like that. But I'm so happy that you are here and I'm able to be here with you as well. We are going to talk tonight about slavery a little bit, and we are going to discuss some of the perceptions that we have about this institution. And we want to make sure that we have a clear narrative. At least that's here on the record, and we have a clear narrative as it relates to that institution and its impact and its power that keeps things in the state that it's in. So we want to do that, and we have some folks that are going to join us, are going to share some things with us that, you know, makes all of this relevant. So I'm really happy that they're here. So I wanted to also add that, you know, we are here every Tuesday night, as you know, from 8 o'clock Eastern Time to 10 o'clock Eastern Time, and also 7 Central to 9 Central. And we are also broadcasting on the network of Time for an Awakening, timeforanawakening.com, timeforanawakening.com, which is also a part of the blacktalkradionetwork.com. So you can reach us there, and then we have a very extensive archives of all of our programs that you can go back and listen to. If you miss one of the Tuesday evenings, you can go back and get a copy and listen to that. Or if you want to go back to review it as you talk about it. We want you to use this format, use this information that we present, you know, whether good or bad. It doesn't mean necessarily that we think that this is law. It's dialogue, and it's attempt to try to create conversation and hopefully be able to help and aid individuals build very productive agendas and curriculums that can make a real difference in the lives of people. And so we want to make this a meaningful conversation. So each Tuesday we try to make it very meaningful and very relevant to our community. As we talk about and look at so many of the things around us, we want to provide some kind of dialogue, discussion, ideas that can definitely contribute to some type of change. And so that's why we're here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We are sort of a think tank format is a one where you just explore, you ask questions, and you challenge ideas. We're not necessarily trying to provide, you know, truth. Well, I mean, whatever truth is, however you define that, that's not necessarily the golden objective here is to provide information. And you take the information, and then you can make truth out of the information, and hopefully it can be used as a weapon for change. So with that said, as you know, we have several other programs that are on this network. We have a program that airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. Eastern Time to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. That program is produced by our sponsor, who sponsors the Black Reality Think Tank. That's Motherland Media Network, and it's called African Perspectives, and its host is Brother Oshiemi Adelabu, African Perspectives, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then on Monday and Wednesday from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., another Motherland Media production system is with Brother Franklin Jones, the Black People Matrix. The Black People Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. That's every Monday and Wednesday from 1 p.m. Eastern to 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Central to 2 p.m. Central. And that also airs, and that is a part of the Motherland Media Network broadcast programs. Also, we have on Friday evenings from 8 o'clock to 10, Time for an Awakening, which is hosted by Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And they are the organizers and developer of the Time for Awakening Network. And they have a program, very dynamic talk dialogue program, every Friday evening from 8 to 10. And then on Sundays from 7 to 10. The same thing with timeforanawakening.com. And there are other programs on as well. I will be naming a few of those later on into our program. I want to indicate also that we are excited about an upcoming. The Black Reality Think Tank is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. This is a group of young people. A lot of them are centered in Howard University in Washington, D.C., and some others are centered here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And we just had a meeting with the group, and we're going to be bringing back on the air a discussion with young people, and that's going to be done very shortly, and they're going to be talking about things that impact them, the millennials, who they are and what that means and what all of this means to them, because very clearly it's they're at the center of all of this discussion because they have to carry it on. So they're going to be coming on with their own program They're working out the day and time, and we're either going to do it on the Time for an Awakening Network, depending on the time slot situation, or we may have to go to Blog Talk Radio and do it. So if that's the case, we'll do that. But nevertheless, they will be on virtually, and I'm very excited about having that. As you know, one of the things that we do here on the Black Reality Think Tank is we always do an ancestral profile. And the ancestral profile is designed to give credence to our ancestors whose shoulders we stand on. These are mighty giants who made it possible for us to be here today and talk and discuss. And we owe them a tribute to continue this work and pass it on to that next generation. So today we're going to talk about a brother out of Boston, Massachusetts. And I know over the weeks and months that we've been on air, we've talked about a lot of folk out of Boston. And Boston is a very interesting city as it relates to a lot of our ancestors because they were centered there. And these were key figures in the movement for liberation. Well, this is another brother from that area. His name is David Walker. David Walker. David Walker was born in 1796. Some say it was 1797, between the two, in Wilmington, North Carolina. He transitioned on August 6, 1830, in Boston, Massachusetts. He was an African abolitionist who wrote a dynamic, scathing attack on slavery and on the people who were enslaved under that system, but who seemed to have been doing very little to free themselves. The name of his pamphlet was An Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. And he wrote that in 1829. And as one historian, Dr. Turner, in one of his books, indicated he in the foreword. I'm sorry, in the foreword of a recopy of David Walker's appeal, indicated that there was a strong argument that can be made that it was David Walker's appeal that inspired a lot of revolts, and particularly the Nat Turner revolt. Obviously, there are those who dispute that, but that's at least Dr. Turner's conclusion. And he did that, as I said, in the foreword to a republished copy of David Walker's appeal. David Walker was urging the enslaved Africans to fight for their freedom. This particular document was one of the most radical documents of the anti-slavery movement. He was born of an enslaved father and a free mother. David Walker grew up a free man. He obtained an education and traveled throughout the country, settling eventually in Boston, Massachusetts. There he became involved in the abolitionist movement and was a frequent contributor to Freedom's Journal, which was a paper that was actually the first black newspaper that was started. It was an anti-slavery weekly. Sometime in 1820s, he opened a secondhand clothing store in the Boston waterfront. And through his business, through this clothing store, he could purchase clothes that were taken from sailors in barter for drink and then resell them to seamen who were about to embark. As you know, Boston is a big shipping town. And so a lot of the ships that would come in from Europe and Africa, a lot of them would come into Boston, which may have a lot to do with why the inhabitants and our ancestors were settled there in the Boston area. But at least in the copious pockets of these garments, David Walker would put a copy of his appeal. He would sneak a copy of his appeal in the pockets of the clothes that he sold to sailors. And in doing so, he reasoned that this would reach a lot of the southern ports, and eventually, hopefully, these sailors would pass it through the hands of others, and even get into the hands of other used clothes dealers who would know what to do with them. He also used sympathetic black seamen to also distribute the pamphlets. So they would come into Boston, he would give the black seamen copies of the book, and he would tell them to pass it down wherever they went, in particular those southern states. When the smuggled pamphlets began to appear in the South, the states reacted drastically with legislation prohibiting circulation of abolitionist literature and forbidding the enslaved Africans to learn to read and write. He warned that his life was in danger. Walker refused to flee. He refused to run to Canada. Later, his body was found soon afterward near his shop, and many believed he had been poisoned. The official records, however, indicated that he died of tuberculosis. David Walker's appeal for a slave revolt, widely reprinted after his death. It was accepted by a small minority of abolitionists, but most of the anti-slavery leaders and free blacks rejected his call for the violence at the time. David Walker's only son, and we did talk about him in a previous program, David Walker's only son, Edward G. Walker, was elected to the Massachusetts legislature in 1866. David Walker, David Walker's appeal. I don't know how many of you have read that, but that is a powerful, dynamic book. And as one reads it, you have to take it in the context of the time that he was writing that. And one of the first approaches in his appeal was to attack the church, the black church, and some of its loathfulness that it was doing, and calling people to arms. So David Walker's appeal, very powerful, dynamic book. Okay, we're going to move on. We do have a co-host that joins us from time to time. She's not on as of yet, but hopefully she will join us. If not, then we'll proceed right on as we move forward. Tonight, we're going to talk about a topic. And what inspired me to look at this is I was listening to a discussion or a series of lectures on C-SPAN where these writers were talking about the economics, the American economic system and slavery, and just how truly connected that they are. And so I thought maybe we wanted to talk about it. And one of the things that they were doing that was really interesting is that they were saying that slavery was an economic institution, and the bottom line. And the only way to view it is you have to view it through economics. And I contend that that is totally a false statement to make, that there's more, much more to the horror of that. Now, for the colonies and the Europeans, it may have been an economic institution, but for our people, very clearly, it had more impact coming from its horror. And so, as we try to understand and as we try to study and look at this institution and look at this system, I just thought maybe we want to talk about how to encourage our people, how to encourage our children as we teach them about their history, exactly how to see that and why. Now, you know, one of the things I've done often, and I've done it as a historian, is just take this horrible institution and kind of put it up on my radar right in front of me, and then give it some deep introspection. And just ask myself, what was this? What could it have done to make things the way it is today? How could that system have implemented some of the activities and behaviors and pain and suffering and trauma that African people have endured throughout the planet Earth? What was it that system did? What was the methodology of implementing that much pain? And so if you said it was just an economic system, that won't explain that. You can't explain how that operated. You can't explain why in 2019 we are leading some of the most catastrophic issues in the world, you know, in terms of health, in terms of economics, education, a lot of trauma, a lot of pain. So you have to explain this in some way. And we owe that, as I said, to our ancestors who were fighting to change this ugly system. We need to tell our children and our families just how that happened. How does the prison industrial complex play into slavery if it was just an economic institution? And so that's the question we want to ask, you know. And so if you're one that belongs to that school of thought that says that it was just about economics, as I indicated in the promotional piece, you're missing the boat, brother or sister, and you're lost, because it's definitely more to that. I was looking at some resources that over the years that I'd read in grad school and places that talked about the you know, the economics of slavery. I think one of the most monumental works that was done by a brilliant Caribbean brother who was the prime minister of Tobago, Trinidad. His name was Eric Williams. He wrote a book called Capitalism and Slavery. And according to reviewers, they say he argued that the declining economics of the British West Indies led to the abolition of the slave trade and of slavery. But the recent research on that has rejected this idea, conclusion. It is now clear that the colonies of the British Caribbean profited tremendously. And again, economic-wise, the colonies profited. Yes, it was center for them. But in order to make this system perpetual and to keep it ongoing, other things had to be put in place that are a lot more horrific than just dealing with lifestyle of an economic system. So slavery and American Economic Development, which is another book that was written. This is a book that, kind of a small book, wasn't big. It's a rare book, and it does talk about, again, the whole American economics and how slavery, and it does argue definitely in favor of the fact that slavery was an economic system, and it must be understood from that position and on that position only. That's a book you might want to look at. It was by Charles Dew, D-E-W. That was a book. It was reviewed in the Journal of Interdisciplinary History. Take a look at that. And then I guess one of the landmark studies that was done on that was a book called Time on the Cross. It's the Economics of American Slavery. And this was done, this book was written by Robert William Fogel and Stanley Engelman, and the Fogel and Engelman study. And it's also a quantitative study, too, of slavery. But they are European scholars. They were economic historians. They argue very heavily on the side that it was just a economic institution. And there are others, but I thought I would just mention those in case any of our listening audience may be interested in looking at some material behind that. But I thought maybe that I found this one quote that I think will really help us understand a lot about where I'm coming from in terms of the fact that it's more to it than just that. And this quote comes from a brother. He's a recent writer, and he's done some monumental work. He wrote a book called The Underground Railroad, and his name is Colson Whitehead. Colson Whitehead, and he wrote a book called The Underground Railroad. And here's what he said in there. Here's a quote. He says, "And America, too, is a delusion. It is the grandest one of all." He said, "The white race believes with all its heart that it is their right to take the land, to kill Indians, to make war, to enslave their brothers. This nation shouldn't exist. If there is any justice in the world, for its foundations are murder, theft, and cruelty. Yet, here we are." Colson Whitehead, the Underground Railroad. And I think that is really the way we have to begin to address this whole issue. And so as these white historians began to develop their work around the economics of it, we must begin to look at what it has done in terms of trauma, devastation, and destruction of Black life and Black families and Black communities. That is so critical that we must look at it from that perspective. And so that's what we want to talk about a little bit tonight. Now, I had put on the promotional material, the dialogue, and we got some very good responses. I had asked one of the good brothers, who was a regular discussant here on the Black Reality Think Tank, if he would come on and kind of share with us a discussion he had with the Honorable Judge Russell Stamper. He and Brother James Pugh, who were here, two brilliant minds, were responding to that ad. And Brother Pugh responded first, and then Judge Stamper responded to him. And that was a dialogue that ensued thereafter, a very lengthy one. And you might, if you have an opportunity, go to the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page, and you could see that discussion. But I asked my Brother Pugh to come on tonight and kind of, if he would come on and just kind of share with us a little bit the essence of that conversation. Because it was a lot included, and that's why I want him to come on and talk about it. He included some things. And I think the bottom line, to make sure that we are clear, is to look at how we need to view what that institution was about. Economics, yes. Don't get me wrong. I'm not denying that economics wasn't a very central part of slavery. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying in reference to African people, African community, African families, there are some other things that we must examine. And I'm going to go through some of those in a few minutes. But first, I want to bring Brother Pugh on and ask him, would he share with our listening audience a little of the dialogue between him and Judge Russell Stamper. Judge Stamper was a municipal court judge here in Milwaukee, and a brilliant mind. And he's still here, and he's still operating. I love him dearly, and I really appreciate that he responded. So good afternoon, Mr. Pugh. How are you today?
Pretty good, Doctor. Good evening, I guess.
Thank you. Now,
you had said something about slavery and economics, and you know, if you would, I'd like to speak to that.
That's fine.
I'm gonna speak to it really, really tightly. Okay. You know, there's no contradiction between what you're saying and as slavery being about economics, right, and at the same time slavery being cruel.
Yes.
In fact, you know, just to give you a couple of examples, one from our own personal experience, we know, for example, of people who, you know, want to rob somebody. But in the process of robbing them, there ends up being all kind of ugly things that they end up having to do. But those things are not essential to what their intent was. Their intent was to get money. The book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That talks about, the assassinations and all the kind of destruction that you have to do into a society in order to basically rape a people in perpetuity. So there are all kinds of moral and physical and so on consequences, but the actual impetus, you know, the motivation was the fact that, you know, you wanted to live off the sweat of somebody else's brow.
Right.
But now, with respect to Dr. Stamper, well, let me see if I can just kind of recall what it was is that, you know, you had mentioned the topic, and I mentioned that you had said that you were interested in some of the links. Some of the keys, I think you said, some of the keys to slavery. I think that was a word you used, something like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so what I was interested in doing was suggesting a few of the keys. And I was, and so I introduced this book that we had mentioned on this show before about Hobbes, about the role of Hobbes and Locke and Adam Smith and their role in racism. And what, Judge Stamper said was, let's see, tracking the original concepts of these white devils, discussing and analyzing them, presenting them to the power elite devils who control and benefit. This computer I'm on is just all kind of stuff. Who control and benefit, the author may sell more books, but, in other words, I don't want to go too far, but what Judge Stanford was saying was that, I think he said that, we really don't need to, hear from, from this author.
Right. That's the gist. So maybe you can explain why you feel it's necessary that we do hear from them. Why do we need to talk about her?
Right. I'm going to let's see the dominance of what's called reason. I wanted to get specifically what Judge Stanford said, but he was basically saying that, his argument was basically that, look, if you think that, well, in other words, because Goza was essentially appealing to the morality of somebody, he was making a moral kind of argument.
Okay.
What Judge Stanford was saying is that these people, you're just hollering at the moon, that these people are impervious to moral arguments, and therefore, it's really a waste of time, right?
Right.
And so what I said was that, I think the analysis is a whole lot deeper than just white people. That's certainly one part of our problem. But we also have the problem called how to make a healthy society. And in order to make a healthy society, what we need to understand is how beliefs work, how it's possible for people to delude themselves and think that what they're doing is proper, whether it's proper or not. You heard the expression, who you gonna believe, me or your lying eyes, right?
Right.
So what that says is that once a person is committed to believing something, that they will ignore anything that contradicts that and sort of reinforce what they already believe. That's what cults do. That's what, all religions do. So what I was saying is that one of the advantages that I thought that you got when you read Goza is that a lot of times when you read these arguments, they're so long, they're so complex, they got so many parts to it, that by the time you hear something, you really don't even know what you heard. But the advantage that I thought with Goza is that he makes a fairly succinct argument talking about, some pretty complex philosophical issues, but he makes them fairly briefly and briefly enough that you can keep them in your mind to work with them. And so what I said is that if you dismiss, his preaching, if you dismiss, his, appeals to, morality of this and morality of that and morality of the other, and just look at the structure of the arguments that he brought, that's something useful, particularly for somebody who's attempting to reconstruct their community.
Yeah, that's right. That's good. Great. Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted you to do, because it leads right into the discussion about, this system and really what it is. I mean, like you said, very clearly, not denying it's not economics. You're right. A lot of the world got rich off of the enslavement of African people. The reason the Germany is as wealthy as it is, even though they may be talking about their recessions and all, well, that's something else. That wasn't the way it was. The reason that Hitler was able to mass a military system the way it is because of how much influence they had around the world, where they had used labor, what Berlin did, and not only that, but what the Belgians did, and the money that they had. And then when they took Africa in the Berlin Conference and divided up, all of that came out of this ugly system. And so economics, yeah, but for us, that doesn't have a meaning in the way that it would soothe our trauma and our ills. And that's what I wanted to do. So as I was listening to this talk on C-SPAN, it was just making me real sick because I just couldn't believe that these supposedly brilliant minds could not understand that pain and suffering and what that has done. And so you're right, Brother Pugh. I wanted you to.
Well, no. Could you elaborate that?
Yeah, and I am. I'm getting ready to go right into it. I'm gonna give you some examples. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna give some examples to our listening of just how slavery is so far beyond just economics, and that's what I did because we only have 2 hours. I can't do with so much. But why we have to go beyond that economic picture and try to understand, you know, what slavery has done. We know that it built the tobacco industry. We know that it built the cotton industry. We know all of that. But I want to go deeper. So let me start here. Here's an article that I read not too long ago of how embedded the impact of slavery is in our day-to-day life in 2016, just how it has used and its devastation that it has in these coded messages of 2019. Here is an article that this brother wrote, and he says that is in a typical U.S. advertisement for Magnum ice cream. There is a young white woman in that ad who is devouring an ice cream treat coated in chocolate. She's eating the ice cream with chocolate running all over it. And he says that the sexiest advertising gimmick of using a sexualized woman to sell a product is pretty rare. We know that. We know how that's been used. The blonde, supposedly bombshell Mae West used to sell Muriel cigars. They put a naked woman on a John Deere tractor, the automobile industry and all the automobile. So we know how they use women and sex to sell. But he goes on to say that this sexist advertising gimmick of using a sexualized woman to sell a product is patently obvious. He said, what's less clear about the ad is that they contain racialized symbolism. And this is getting at what we're talking about here. He said the brand is sexualized, first of all, by its apparent international association with the condom brand. Magnum is the same company that makes the Magnum condom that markets itself as designed for larger than average penises. And then he says in many of the acts of this advertisement, a white woman suggestively places the ice cream in her mouth, and that the ice cream is dark chocolate, coated, suggests a specific connection to the historically taboo intimacy of black men and white women. Now, this is his opinion. He says that the British-Dutch parent company, Unilever, which makes Magnum ice cream, has come under fire before in the U.S. for these racist-type advertisements, including the Dove body wash, and in other countries for their racist promotions of Magnum ice cream. He says that a commercial widely used across the globe clearly deploys the racial symbolism. In Pakistan, he says, in 2016, Magnum launched an ad campaign by having a black man covered in chocolate sit in a bathtub. This was a feminized space associated with indulgence and sensuality. You always see a picture of women in the bathtub with bubbles all blowing up and just laying there. Anyway, the man evidently himself waiting to be consumed, his body indistinguishable from the chocolate confection. Some might see the Magnum advertisement as entirely about the pleasure of ice cream, maybe even a positive ad. But if we accept that, the subtext depiction of black men costs them as desirable. He goes on to say that the Magnum commercial that he saw is but one example of how the dominant culture today still uses the images of black men as symbols of pleasure and power that can be consumed, they can be harnessed, and used by whites for their own purposes. I know, he says, that I interpret the Magnum ads in a particular way because my most recent research has been about sexual exploitation of enslaved men. And it has sensitized me to the sexual exploitation of black men that carries to this day from a system created for the purpose of enslavement. He says that under slavery, black men were characterized as hypersexual. Sexualized imagery of black men first emerged significantly in the early 19th century. He said there were racist images of black men who have their roots in the enslavement system. But ironically, it was the abolitionists who unwittingly contributed to an already established culture of objectification of enslaved people when they circulated images of black men's exposed bodies. In reality, most enslaved men survived on meager diets. They suffered regular injuries from hard labor and carried the extensive scars and brands of a brutal system of enslavement. He said that many abolitionists, however, depicted enslaved men with the glorified physiques of Greek and Roman statues. Portraying black men's body in this style, he says, linked them to virtue and character and intellect associated with the Greco-Roman ideas. Some imagery, such as Marcel Antoine Verdier's Beating at Four Stakes, which was done in 1843, contrasted the body type associates with these ideas with the conditions of slavery to underscore the absurdity of the institution of slavery. The British artist Richard Ansdale, who did a picture called The Hunted Slaves, for another example, it illustrated a muscularly powerful man defending his wife from dogs as they escaped enslavement. Others placed enslaved men in poses that echoed those used in the classical world. The Freedman, for example, he said in 1862, bears a striking resemblance to the statue Boxer at Rest. And so the abolitionists circulated these images of enslaved men that portrayed them as godlike men. Fascination with the physique of black men was also rampant in the art world. In 1810, the British painter Benjamin Haydon wrote about his near obsession with black men's bodies. In his diary, Haydon described a fetishization of a man from Boston whose name was Wilson, who he referred to as the Black, a man he sketched, drew, and concluded was a beauty in any position. Haydon's approach showed a callous disregard for Wilson's welfare. When he went to replicate his full body in plaster, Wilson nearly suffocated and had to be broken out of the mold. Yet, Haydon reflected not about the near tragedy, but instead he focused on the intact pieces of the coats of Wilson's posterior and his genitals, writing that he thought they were the most significant and beautiful sight on the planet Earth. And he goes on to explain this idea. And he goes on to indicate others who did become fascinated. The white woman very clearly made room and a way for her to be able to indulge in black men. So I think what I'm saying, the point that I'm making in all of this, is the sexualization out of slavery, I think, was much more powering and devastating to the African than anything else. And the way that we have seen the description, for instance, of African women, the Hottentot woman, and all of the language of that, is what really created this passion to keep this institution going. It's well understood, you know, well understood what the European thought and saw in the enslaved women of the plantation, and all of the literature and tons of literature of the rape and the imposition on women from that, and the results of it and how it happened. And not only just the plantation owners, but a lot of times the workers and the lowlifes of the plantation system took advantage of that as well. And it was not considered to be a problem. Women, the wives of the plantation, were made to accept that and to accept it as a way of life. There is a book written by a woman named Catherine Clinton. She was a Harvard historian. She wrote a book called The Plantation Mistress, and where she talks about what the white woman, the wife of the planter, was forced to accept, you know, in relationship to his behavior in terms of women. And so the sexual drive, the sexual nature of slavery, from my understanding and my research, has a lot more power in relationship to devastating the African in terms of a discussion about the economics of slavery. I mean, you have to look at that too, but I think what we want to begin to ask questions about, why would they were willing to, for instance, not want to end this system? Why did it take so long to bring it to a close? Because it was a system of pleasure as well. And it had very powerful sentimentality for a lot of the Europeans that were there. It's an ugly history. I agree to that. And historically, we don't like to talk about it. You have to talk about it. The rape of men and that whole forcing of the homosexual thing in the plantation system and what that looked like. And those beatings, a lot of that was sadomasochism. They weren't beating them to punish them. They were beating them for pleasure of the, based on the sadomasochist nature. I tried to find the author's name today. He wrote a book that discusses this whole spirit of the Victorian age, which was that age in England right after slavery. And what he argues is that the European male was so defiled coming out of the institution of slavery that they had to implement a Victorian code of ethics, because they were doing things and had been used to doing things that they were really not able to stop. So things that, like the chastity belt and some of those other ideas, and this was a sort of a social history of that particular time, had a lot to do, he argues, this book argues, with why that age took on the way it did. And so I think as we look at it and as we begin to try again to understand it for ourselves, as we talk about healing and some of these things, the scars go deep, and they go very deep into some of the practices that were done, not in the name of economics. They were done in the name of just brutal, cruel behavior. And as Colin Whitehead said, he asked in the question, who are these people? Who in God's name were they, you know, to do that to another human being? And then all of the justification that had to be made to make it palatable for the world to see what they were doing. They said, they're not really animals. They're not really humans. They're animals. And then there's that work that Margaret Washington did on all of that medical stuff that they did. It had nothing to do with economics. What was that? So a lot of the study of medicine, early medicine, and all the study of medical procedures and surgery came out of this ugly system. And then there's some stuff that has been written on that. Like, let me give you an example. It says that these medical experiments that were done on the black body, and particularly women. There was a one man in Georgia. There was a story written about a guy in Georgia. His name was John Brown, not the John Brown of the John Brown's rape. But he was an enslaved man, and he was on a Baldwin County, Georgia plantation in the 1820s and 30s. And he was purchased by a physician by the name of Dr. Thomas Hamilton. And Hamilton was obsessed with proving that physiological difference between black and white people existed. Hamilton went on to use Brown to try to determine how deep, now check this out, how deep black skin went. How deep into the body did black skin go? Believing that black skin was thicker than white skin. Brown, the enslaved African who eventually escaped to England, wrote about it, and recorded his experiences in an autobiography published in 1855, and the name of it is Slave Life in Georgia, a narrative of the life, sufferings, and escape of John Brown, a fugitive slave now in England. And I think that book is available in some, you got to go to some, well, at least it's available in the archives of probably the Smithsonian and New York Public Library. But I think it would be worthy to look at. Margaret Washington uses some of that in her book. And it goes on to say that in Brown's words, what this Dr. Hamilton did is he applied blisters to his hands. He created blisters on his hands, his legs, and feet, which bear, he said, the scars to this day. And that's the day he wrote that book. He continued until he drew up the dark skin from between the upper and under one, he said. He used to blister me at intervals of about 2 weeks. He said, this went on for 9 months, Brown wrote, until the doctor's experiments had so reduced me that I was useless in the field. John Brown, who escaped slavery and published an autobiography about this experience, as I've indicated, and there's a copy of it in the Schomburg Research Center. And he was basically, supposedly, the doctor, a respected Southern gentleman, respected position, and he was a trustee of the Medical Academy of Georgia. And like many other doctors of that era in the South, he also was a wealthy plantation owner who tried to use science to prove that the difference between black people and white people went beyond culture and were more than skin deep, insisting that black bodies were composed and functioned differently than white bodies. They believed that black people had large sex organs and small skulls, which translated to promiscuity and a lack of intelligence. And if you think this is not relevant, read The Bell Curve, which was done in 1994. And a higher intolerance for heat, as well as the immunity to some illness and susceptibility to others. These fallacies, presented as fact and legitimized in medical journals, bolstered society's view that enslaved people were fit for little outside forced labor and provided support for racist ideology and discriminatory public policies. In the New York Times 1619 project that they've been doing, there was some of this information was in that publication. And it talked about that 400-year history and as a part of it. Now, why this is important? Well, we talk about healing slavery. We talk about ending racism. But see, this stuff is still embedded in the American ideological structure. There are still probably physicians and doctors who believe that there is a difference between black people and white people. And as a result, they may not want to treat them, they may not want to do certain things, or they may not, they misdiagnose situations if they do try to treat or deal with it. And so this is beyond economics. To argue that slavery was nothing more than economics erases the possibility of this kind of thing. It erases, takes that out of the discussion platform. And this needs to be in the discussion platform. And historically, we have not wanted to do that. We have, it has been truly omitted from all history books. We don't talk about it as a people. When you talk about healing and applying treatments, you talk about deprogramming, reprogramming the African mind. This is what you're reprogramming from, this type of behavior and practices. And there are other horrible stories like this that you can look at that goes on to show you that mistreatment you know, and you're looking at what, the 1800s, you know, slavery, 1850s, 1840s, you know, not quite 200 years old yet. And a lot of that still lingers. So that's why I wanted to talk about that and give yourselves a chance. And I know Brother Pugh and Judge Stanford had a very dynamic argument. Brother Pugh was quoting a philosophy from the ancient period of Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, and some of the beliefs and ideas that have it. And I know that it does not necessarily need, some people may feel, to be discussed. What good is it going to do? It's not going to change them. But I think we have to understand what was done to us. We have to put into the universe of what our ancestors went through. Their people must know who we are dealing with. Who are we asking to sit at the table with? We are asking to sit at the table with folk who may very well still think like that, you know. And I know that, and I know that very clearly, you know, that creates some horrible thoughts. But it's a reality that we have to look at. So let me go over here and take just a quick look. I see our co-host is on, Ms. Ayan. She's just joined us. Good afternoon, Ms. Ayan. How are you?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Oh, great. Good evening. How are you?
I'm going to have back in about 2 minutes.
You broke up real bad. Say it again.
I have to call back from another phone.
Okay. All right. Okay. My good friend, Brother Herbie White. How you doing, Brother White? Hi. Well, wait a minute, Brother White. Yeah, there he is. Okay. How you doing, Brother White?
I'm doing pretty good, Dr. Rogers. Hi. Greetings and hotep to everybody on the show that's listening.
What about all this, you know, I've been talking about? What do you think about all this?
Well, just to add to what you were talking about,
uh-huh.
The idea of lynching as recreation.
Uh-huh.
That white people advertise a lynching. Schools were let out. They brought their families to sit down and eat and watch a person be hung and burned and dismembered as a form of entertainment.
That's right.
I was 10 years old when I saw the picture of Emmett Till in the Jet magazine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I wished for years and years that I had never seen that picture. So how could I imagine myself as a child going to watch a person being hung and burned and dismembered? What kind of sick individual? I mean, I can't think of any of the children in my family that don't even like to look at scary movies on television.
Right.
And these people did this and took pictures and made postcards and sent them to relatives.
That's right. Sent postcards. That's right. Sure did.
There's no explanation for that.
Cut off of body parts. Cut body parts off and pass them as souvenirs.
And take it home and put it on their mantelpiece.
Right.
There's no human explanation for that.
It's not. And that's not economics.
Ain't got nothing to do with economics.
Nothing to do with economics.
Just psychopathic behavior.
It sure is. But yet, when we want to try to talk about healing it, we try to go into it from another realm. And very clearly, that's not going to explain that. That's not going to explain who we are sitting down at the table with.
And when you talk about healing, and you talk about that group that's at that lynching, that brought their children there and brought their food there, and cut these body parts off, how do you start to heal that?
Okay. You can't.
If you were a psychiatrist, what would be the first thing that you would say to somebody doing stuff like that?
Exactly.
How could you how could you begin to bring them back into the realm of humanity? That's impossible.
That's right. And even the descendants of the families of those victims, how do they heal from that? You know, death is hard to heal from anyway, just normal, natural causes.
Intergenerational trauma.
That's right.
Passed down.
That's right.
All the African men, especially in the South, that went out and never came back.
That's right.
Just went to walk to go from one place to another, and nobody never saw them again.
That's right.
Sundown town.
That's right.
Where all kinds of things would happen to you just for being there. Being assaulted for looking a white man in the eye.
Right.
What does that have to do? That don't have nothing to do with economics.
Nothing.
And that's not something that you can fix. And a lot of these people who did these things back then are heroes to white people today.
Right there in your hometown, back in the early change of the 20th century, they were killing so many black babies. In the various hospitals that people were going to, that they had to create an investigation to find why all these black babies were dying. The infant mortality rate was so high right there in Durham. You ever read some of that?
No, this is new to me.
Oh, man, big time. Duke even had to get in it because in some cases, you know, a lot of, you know, during the 30s, Duke had a segregated facility for babies, for mothers to have birth. That's why a lot of people chose to have births at home, because they were scared to go to the hospital and get their baby killed, be killed. And so there was a project that Duke started, and I've been doing some research on finding where's the paperwork on it, but, you know, they've got it well hid. I would have to come to Durham and get something. There was a project called the Pentagraph Babies. And this man named Pentagraph, you know, Pentagraph was a very popular name in Durham. And the Pentagraph physician, Dr. Pentagraph, created a special clinic just so that he could help black babies, black mothers and black families successfully complete childbirth without them dying in birth, and some of the things that were going on. And I was a Pentagraph baby. You know, I was born in the 40s, born in 1944. And I asked the question one time, how is it possible that I was born at Duke Hospital? And that was a segregated hospital. And the person that explained that history to me was older, and they said, you were probably a Pentagraph baby. I said, a what? They said, a Pentagraph baby. And they said that Dr. Pentagraph was a doctor at Duke that decided to, you know, to take on birth, helping black mothers birth their children successfully. So, and you know that's still going on. There's still high infant mortality rates in a lot of places. And so
yeah,
they're still killing our babies, you know, and so it's a major issue. Well, thank you, Brother White. I really appreciate that. Let me go over here to, we got a caller that hadn't been with us for a while. They have been on the show, calling from Texas. I don't know if she wants to say something, but if you had anything to add to this conversation, I'm going to catch you before you hang up. Good afternoon, my sister. How you doing?
Are you referring to me, Doc?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
I'm just chiming in, listening. Thank you so much. I'm just chiming in, listening. I try to catch the show when I can. So I'm just
okay. Yeah, and I know you're busy.
Getting my education, but yeah, I'm totally in agreement with. We have to be very conscious and aware of the people that we deal with. We really do, because, like you said, we're asking sit at the table of individuals who poisoned our food. and did it in our faces.
Exactly.
And even at times made us poison each other's food.
Right.
So I do think that there's a lot that goes into that when it comes to trust. And then sometimes I just wonder what are the options? What are the options? Because we're
good
working
question.
From
good question.
Such a disadvantaged point, because in a lot of ways we have to sit at the table with them in order to get, in order to come out of the bondage that we're currently under. We have to engage with certain individuals. However, how can we possibly trust these individuals? How can we ever look at them and know that their ancestors, quite possibly are directly involved in the demise of our direct ancestors? We really don't know who we're talking to and what their lineage is. So I think it's a really important conversation.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, appreciate it. Listen as long as you can. I definitely appreciate you, as you know that. My sister that's talking had her own radio show previously, and she's getting ready to go back to some of that type of thing very soon. She has an organization called Soul Sister Stand Up, and it's about family building and liberation of families, you know, and women, particularly among women. So I'm glad to have you on to talk about that. And we're going to talk more about how the Black Reality Think Tank can support Soul Sister Stand Up in the future.
Thank you. I'm sitting here chiming in with my notepad, taking my notes.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
Sister Yan, you're back. Again, welcome. I'm glad you're with us. Anything you want to add to this conversation?
Just a little. Unfortunately, I came on around, I don't know what time it is, but just a few minutes ago, so only heard a very little
right.
of what was been said, but I get the gist of of the conversation. I heard sitting at the table a few times, I think from you and the sister that just talked, and we have to sit at the table with each other. We have to do that.
Yes.
And because, you know, and Doc, make sure you send me this, please, so I can hear the first half of the show. But I'm hearing you talking about savagery and savages. And one thing that I see in dealing, well, a couple of things that I see in dealing with trauma is that, as I said before, our people have a really hard time facing the level of savagery that we've had to experience, savagery and torture. And it's so important to use those words because that's what it was.
Right.
It wasn't mistreatment. You know, it wasn't a sin. It was savagery and torture. And which traumatized us, absolutely. And so when you're suffering from trauma as a result of that, it's very hard to look at that. And that's why we have to sit at the table. You know, we can sit at the table with the enemy, because you do. I believe you have to know your enemy. But in addition to that, we got to, I would say, just really pressure each other, even force ourselves to sit at the table with each other.
Right. That's true, too. Definitely.
Yeah. And help us to look at the things that many of us can't handle looking at.
Right.
You know, I've spoken with several people over the past week. I'm always talking to the various people. And I see a pattern with people who identify themselves as, you know, a Republican, a conservative, or they're just not into all that black empowerment stuff, needs to be all people. I see one thing in common, and that's that they are afraid of their own anger.
Mm-hmm.
If they see this stuff, when I try to put something in their faces, the first thing that comes out of the mouth is, that's just going to make me angry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want to feel hate, and I don't want to deal with the anger.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are afraid of the anger that's inside of us, and it's inside of everybody that has any inkling about what happened, the torture that we've gone through, and we do.
Mm-hmm.
The response is we are afraid of what's inside of us,
that's
that
right.
anger, because we don't know what to do with it. And so the first step is sitting at the table with each other, because when we do things, difficult things together, it becomes easier. You know, when I share my pain with you, my brother, my sister, then my burden becomes lighter. But if I just run around holding on to it myself, then it just builds in me. You know, that's a universal law. So so that's the importance of forcing us to look at the realities of what we're dealing with, because we will never, I'm laughing out of just frustration, we will never begin taking those steps toward liberation like we used to if we keep hiding. You know, through the various ways that we hide from the realities of the torture that happened in the past and that continues to happen. You know, when these lunatics can just shoot our men on camera right in front of everybody's face.
It's getting worse.
Yeah. And it happens all of the time. At some point, we're going to have to open our, the people that don't want to open their eyes, and I think I would say that's the majority of us, are scared too, because we're afraid of our own anger. They're afraid of their own anger, because I can deal with my anger now. Are going to be forced to, as this violence and the savagery picks up in front of our eyes.
That's right.
So it's very critical, and I love that you're emphasizing that this wasn't about economics, because you get no economic gain by gouging out somebody's eyes before you lynch them.
Right, right.
What's the economic gain?
Yeah, and we didn't get it. We didn't get the economic gains. It wasn't good. It didn't go to us.
That's right. That's right.
No, our people.
But when they claim, well, slavery was about economics, that's BS.
Right.
Just one more quick thing. As we know, Doc, wherever they go all over the globe, they have a formula. Call the black people or the brown people savages. Label them as savages.
Right.
And then civilize the savages through torture, violence, Christianity, and rape. Rape is just, I'm finding out, so huge in Africa, especially at raping African boys.
Yes.
It's just, it was horrible, and it still continues. So, yeah. They've been practicing this since they got on this earth. However they got on this earth, I don't even know. I don't know about that, you know, some of the origin stories. But, yeah, that's what we're dealing with. Not all, of course, but enough to impact us and to continue to damage us.
Exactly.
Psychologically,
right.
A lot, you know, because you can do the physical stuff, that's obvious, but when we can't see the psychological damage, you know, that's where we get stuck.
That's where we get stuck, and that's what causes what you see around us now.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, all right, well, you know, if you hold on as long as you can, and if you got to go, I understand. You know, we are a call-in format here at the Black Reality Think Tank. Our call-in number is area code 215-490-9832. Again, I repeat, 215 area code 490-9832. And we'd love to have you call and give your input to what the discussion tonight is. We're looking at the institution of chattel slavery, how we as African people need to understand and embrace that. And use it as a healing mechanism, and how to ask the hard questions. You know, how do we get around this? How are we going to get out of this? How is it that? And I've shared with many of you, I have a great grandchild. How is my great grandchild going to avoid having to try to talk about this? You know, some 40, 50 years later. You know, or will she be saying the same thing I'm trying to say sitting here now? So, you know, these are questions that, you know, we must ask ourselves. I'm going to, I know, Brother Pugh, you wanted to come back on. I'm going to bring you on in just a minute. Let me ask my good friend here, Brother Timothy, what do you want to add to this conversation?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. A lot to it, sir.
Okay.
In 1994 to 1998, I was in graduate school, and my professor and also my chair was from India. And he's from Delhi, and he was a colonial writer. I had to find out from him what was a Commonwealth writer. He said to me, Tim, said we write about colonization all over the planet.
Okay.
And he said, one reason I like you as a student is because I can tell you have some type of nationalist background. So our experience with sharing is he talked about colonization with the British in India. And I talked about the experience of slavery on the continent and being brought here in chains. And we went back and forth. He told me about different books like Yom Kippur. I talked about the Middle Passage. And he said that the Europeans' idea coming into India was not just to take out the riches, because they had a 35,000 period like we did in Africa. India was, remember, Columbus was looking for India. Right. He said that they wanted to take the mind of the Indian. He said that the Aryan invasion was to whip him, mangle him, cut him, destroy him, and take away his mother tongue. Boom. Okay. Key. And we talked about the African experience, that when Mungo Park came into Africa, of course he needed Africans to get up in there, okay? That putting them on ships and bringing them to Africa, the disease came in, their lips are big, their hair is different,
mm-hmm.
their skin is different.
Mm-hmm.
That was a way, he said, they were different. We can treat them like they're subhuman. They come with the idea of supplanting. They come with the idea of they have to make you see, convince people that you are not to be treated as a human. You're right. That has nothing to do with economics. Because they took the treasures out of India, they just could have took it.
Right.
They went to Africa, they could have took the resources. But they want to take us because they don't want you around. And it goes further to even with the Jack Johnson, Jack London, who wrote The Call of the Wild, who wrote about the frontier, when it came as a sports writer, he referred to Jack Johnson as the Dinge.
Mm-hmm.
See, this wasn't an athlete who became a phenomenal athlete who knocked out the champ. No. It was the Dinge, the monster, the filth, the dirt.
That's right. Brother Timothy?
Yeah.
Oh, you're there. Okay, right. And so basically, that was one of the reasons for it was labeled that the whole King Kong story was supposedly derived from the Jack Johnson's life. The two guys that created King Kong. And not only did they took it to Japan, and the Japanese created a cinematography version of King Kong. And very clearly, you know what they're talking about. It's obvious as night and day what that story was revealing, as King Kong came into your cities and tore up the city and was after your white women. Very big story. Very positive story. Anything else, Brother Timothy?
I'm learning from everyone, and as we talk more, okay. I have to pull out of my archives and my brain, Dr. Rogers, because so many people bring so much to the plate. I say, let me listen to them a little more.
That's good.
I'll listen, and I'll come back with some more.
Okay, I'll come back to you. All right, I'm gonna see. I don't know, Brother Griffin, are you listening, or you just wanna say something, or you just listening?
Of John Jeter's journalistic.
Brother Griffin, I think your mic was something. We're not hearing you.
That article had absolutely.
Brother Griffin, we can't hear you. Something with your mic. Or your phone, or the phone that you're using, it's not there. We can't hear you at all. Maybe if you could switch up a phone a minute, come back. I want to go to Mr. Pugh in a few minutes and I want him to respond because I had him open up with a comment based on a discussion he had. But before we do that, let me just take a quick break. Let Brother Griffin get his mic together, and we're going to just take a little quick 2 or 3 minute musical break. Let's listen to Sister Nikki Giovanni and one of the masterpieces that she created. And then we're going to come right back with our discussion. Remember, this is a call-in format. We welcome your calls, and we would definitely love to hear from you at some point to do that. So please give us a call. It's your opportunity. Area code 215. We'll come back to you. It's Nikki Giovanni.
Africa is a young man bathing in the back of a prison fortress. The guide said, "Are you Afro-American? Cape Coast Castle holds a lot for your people. And the 18th century clock that keeps perfect time for the time it has." I watched his black skin turn foaming white and wanted to see this magnificent man stand naked and clean before me. But they called me to the dungeon, where above the Christian church, an African stood listening for sounds of revolt. The lock, the guide stated, indicated a major once ran this fort, and the British, he said, had recently demanded the lock's return. And I wanted that lock, maybe for a doorstop, to unstop the 18th century clock. "And there is one African buried here. We are proud of him," he said. And I screamed, "No, there are thousands." But my voice was lost in the room of the women with the secret passageway that leads to the governor's quarters. So Roberta Flack recorded a song and Les McCann cried. But a young African man on the rock outside the prison where my people were born bathed in the sunlight. And Africa is a baby to be tossed about and disciplined and loved and neglected and bitten on its bottom, as I wanted to sink my teeth into his thigh and tell him he would never be clean until he can possess me.
Yeah!
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
As I said, we are call-in format here at the Black Reality Think Tank. Our calling number is area code 215-490-9832. We welcome your calls to add to this discussion, give us your input, or to ask a question. We do appreciate that. So you can do so again. Again, once more, area code 215-490-9832. Okay, Brother Pugh, we started out with you. So as we looked at some of the remarks, what are your thoughts now?
Well, I would say that you and the rest of your guests have done a very good job of presenting the non-economic elements of slavery. And yes. So I would agree that when you talk about the political, the sexual, and the experimental elements. Now, the second point, and so the first point I want to make is that I would agree that these other dimensions actually have their own specific issues that have to be addressed separately than economics. So I would agree with that. But now the second element was that there was this notion of well, which has priority. In other words, the question of if you say there's a sexual dimension to slavery, if you say there's a torture dimension, if you say there's an economic dimension, which one of those dimensions are Trump? And folks are given the impression that somehow or another, you know, that there's this mad desire to torture black people that overrides everything else. And I don't know if that's true or not, but that seems to be, you know, a flavor that's coming out. And then the third thing that I would mention is that there seems to be a sense that this torture is peculiar to black people. It forgets about what the Romans did to Europeans, you know, all the torture. In fact, that's where they got it from. They were reading Cicero's letters of what they were doing to the people that they had enslaved. Forget about what the Romans did to the Christians. Forget about what the Spanish did to the Mississippian Indians and or, for that matter, to the Aztec, the Inca, and so on. In other words, when you conquer a people, you do all kind of crazy things to them. And then finally, forget about the fact that there are a lot of little boys that take cats and put them in microwaves, that take animals and pull their wings and stuff off, or have sex with goats and things. So the notion of somehow or another identifying this as some peculiar behavior that, you know, is just only, you know, it's uniquely, you know, dogmatic against blacks, I don't know that case can be made. Now, it may be, but, you know, at this point, you know, I'm not there on that.
So. Okay, let's get some feedback. Brother White, what you think, Brother Pugh's suggestion, that is just really the evilness of the human animal. How do you see that?
Yeah, it's part of the psychopathic nature of Europeans, but they found someone that they could exercise on it with impunity and with vigor, and so they, you know, took it to a different level. I know that they did it to other people, but the topic of tonight is what happened during slavery. Was it economic alone? And what we find is that it was not only economic, it was the sadistic, okay, cruel, inhuman behavior that took place on a daily basis by everybody that had the opportunity. Is what we're talking about. We know what they did to the Romans. We put them in the arena with lions and stuff like that. They did that. That was part of what they did to the Romans. We're talking about what they did to us and what it encompassed. Was it an economic thing? Or was it something else?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The changing of the names, the destruction of your history, your memory, your religion, everything else to strip you of everything that you had that made you a human being.
Right. And stripped you from being human. Yeah, exactly. Brother Pugh, I wanted to, I remember one of your responses in that thread is you said, you quoted somebody who said something about to do, to be unhuman or to be violent is to be anti-human or something like that. Did you say something that way? I can go back here and look in the thread and see. Do you recall that when you wrote that last? You wrote that after you and...
Well, right. I was talking about Kemet, and I was saying that that's anti-life.
Anti-life, right. That's right. Yeah. What is that quote you said? What is that?
Right, right. Well, I'm not sure if I was quoting anybody. I'm not sure if I was quoting anybody.
Okay,
But the argument that he was making was that... the argument that Judge Stamper made was that... When I said that Pastor Goza was attempting to rehabilitate Christianity, Judge Stamper said that Christianity doesn't need to be rehabilitated, that it's these distortions that the Europeans have made of Christianity, and that, if it had been unmolested, you know, it'd be good to go. And I countered that, well, I actually think that Kemetic civilization itself is anti-life.
Okay.
And that whereas he would say that what the Europeans are doing to Christianity is essentially bastardizing it, I would say that the ideal itself leads to this result because it's an anti-life kind of orientation.
Mm-hmm.
I can go on
okay,
and on, but
right.
that was
and I like that anti-life thing. You're right, because that, and I think that's what Brother White's saying as well. Their behavior is anti-life, you know. Whereas in a case where maybe we put a rat in the microwave or do some crazy stuff like that, I'm not sure that embraces anti-life.
Let me give you an example. Just okay. Last week, what we talked about. Dr. Karinga and his ethos, this notion of Kaiwaeda,
right.
And this ideal of alternative orientations to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that to understand the European ethos, or actually I said really the white ethos, because there are any number of Europeans that don't have this value system. It's actually relatively few, and I can explain why. You don't need everybody.
Right.
But the point is that I said that the four elements of this value system is that they prefer technology to biology. Well, technology, that's a dead thing. That's a machine. They prefer the notion of economics or conquering nature to ecology,
right.
Living in harmony with nature.
Right.
They prefer the few, that is, to the many. In other words, they assume that there are these special people in the world and the world is designed for them, and that everybody else is just raw material to be used, at their disposal. And then the final thing is that they prefer using the mind to using their heart. They
That's
believe in the gangster
That's
rule
right.
that might makes right, as opposed to the golden rule that right makes might. Well, that's a death culture.
Right.
And if
right.
you wanted one word to sort of summarize it, it's the notion of perfection.
That's
that they want to become perfect people. But since human beings are perfectly imperfect, what you have to do to make humans perfect is you have to kill them. And so
right.
that's how you end up with a culture that ultimately worships death, even though they claim that what they really want is immortality or everlasting life. It really can only lead to death.
Right.
But
that
was the point that I was trying to make.
That's a very good point, Mr. Pugh. That really is, because it brings home Dr. John Henry Clark's notion that ice culture from which they came created that. I don't know how many of you saw, and I'm probably one of the few African-Americans that might have looked up, but the Game of Thrones. I watched that whole series, but I watched it for a different reason. I watched it because of the ice culture analogy that's shrouded in there. And, I mean, all of the activity of the Game of Thrones takes place in hostile weather. And it creates a behavior, and it creates a system, as you say, Brother Pugh, an ethos that is definitely different, say, from warmer climates. People who may have lived in warmer climates, or say in the Amazon rainforest, and some of the things that we see in those warmer areas, they don't that prime minister that did not respond to the burning of the rainforest of the Amazon is obviously has an ethos that he doesn't see that's important. It's more about the economics and the business, how they go in and cut the trees down and tear it up. They need the wood. They don't care about the people and what the ecology does. I need some wood. I need to burn coal and pollute the air, yeah, because it makes more money. The stock market has got to respond. We got to respond to the stock market. So it's just expensive trying to burn nuclear energy, you know, so it's better to burn coal. Let's put the coal in there and do it and create the problems that we have. So you know, you're right. Brother White, and then I'm going to go up here to back to see if Brother Griffin got his mic together. What do you think, Brother White? Is that we on the right track here?
Counting and measuring. Dr. Edwin Nichols.
Okay.
Oh, counting, yeah. Counting and measuring.
The Nichols model. Yeah, that's a good model.
Yeah. Anything that they can't count and measure is not worth anything.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
So they can't count and measure humanity.
And I think, Brother Pugh, that's why we looked at Locke and Hobbes and all of those, because I have an interest in studying where that comes from. And philosophically, they looked at when that empirical society came into operation, when the empiricist philosophers began to come forward and teach and bring that theories. And as you know, it's important because what they did is the empirical philosophies became a part of the church and the records and the teachings of the Catholic Church. And you remember the Catholic Church was the canonical law of Europe. And what they did is everything that they said was law. So when they even made decisions on determining that the earth was flat instead of round, that had to do with some understanding of the canonical laws of the Catholic Church. It had nothing to do with science. But then the empirical philosophy studies of people like George Berkeley and Immanuel Kant and all of that group, and they began to, coming Aristotle, that Aristotelian philosophy, which became purely science. And as you know, the arguments out of Europe were arguing over the significance of science versus spirituality. And the church even put into place that they would kill you if you decided not to go along with some of those ideologies. Is that your understanding, Brother Pugh, as well, the origin of some of that? If you look at George Berkeley, Immanuel Kant, and what was the mathematics guy's name? I can't think of his name. He was pre-Kant. He had the mathematical theory. You remember his name? What's his name?
Pre-Kantian mathematician? Maybe you're talking Newton? I'm not sure.
You had that group of empiricists that were arguing for a scientific analysis of the world, and that was the mathematician. I'm just slipping my mind right now, but anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. I remember Kant and David Hume. Remember Hume? Hume's whole argument, and they were pushing this for the church. And now this time, you know, you had Protestantism, so they were pushing it for Protestantism. But is that your understanding?
One of the issues had to do with whether or not. And by the way, this is a complex subject that has a lot of dimensions.
Oh yeah, a lot of dimensions.
One of the issues is that it begins with Plato, and it begins with the notion that there are sort of universal truths. And then one of the things that begins to happen is that the question is, well, how do you get these universal truths? And Plato says you get them from inside of you. And Aristotle says, no, you don't get them from inside. You get them, as you said, empirically.
Right.
You get them
right.
from observation of things outside of you.
Exactly.
And so one of the things that began to happen with the Europeans, with Roger, with Francis Bacon, he's
Bacon.
The guy
there
with knowledge
Bacon.
Is power.
That's,
that's Francis
yeah.
Bacon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Bacon. That's what I was thinking.
And his argument was that, you know, instead of us simply theorizing how we think the world should be, what we ought to do is go out there and actually investigate the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so he began this mm-hmm. process of attempting to do it. One of the things that Goza points out in the book that we were talking about called mm-hmm. America's Unholy Ghost
right.
is he talks about the role that Locke played, that initially the Catholic Church, Thomas Aquinas, had basically, prior to Thomas Aquinas, the Catholic Church was Platonic. It was Neoplatonic.
Yes,
it was basically
yeah.
using the ideas of Plato that truth comes from inside the mind and only a handful full of people can know what the truth is, et cetera. Revelation is the way that you can know. And then with Thomas Aquinas, because of the fact of the power of some of the Aristotelian views, Thomas Aquinas began to read Aristotle and then began to weave Aristotle into the Catholic Church.
Right.
And so one of the things that you had was that the role of the church was basically beginning, you know, like when they talk about in the Bible, it's this thing of these people coming together so that they can look out for everybody.
Right.
Well, one of the things that John Locke did was he basically changed the role of the church and said that it will no longer be a thing where everybody puts all their goods in one pot and then we distribute them to people as they need them, but rather what we want to do is have a society where there are some people who have property and we want to make sure that their property is protected.
That's
so,
the deal.
So instead of everybody being able to help the little people, it's no, everybody should be able to help the big people,
right.
and so on and so forth. But it's you know, there's
like
more
I said, it's many dimensions to it. But that's it. That's and I don't want to complicate it too much. But that's why we mention that. We mention it because on Sunday morning, many of our people are sitting up somewhere in a pew with a cross and a steeple under that kind of teaching, and that's where that teaching is coming from. And what those scriptures do is they make you speak to that that idea, and to the point that you embrace that. That's why we need to talk about that. It's done in your pedagogy of your teach of what we're teaching our children. They're learning that in geography. They're learning it in biology. They're learning it there. They're learning that empirical philosophies and ideas. That were created out of this ethos, this mindset, going all the way back in terms of the captivity of attempt to capture the world. And so some of that evilness is shrined in there. So that's why Dr. Clark, John Henry Clark, he talked about, you know, the fact that they're coming out of an ice culture. And so when I said I watched the Game of Thrones, I was looking at the nature of that ice and what it did to those people, even it's a fictional account, but Europeans know that about themselves. Michael Bradley, in his book, The Iceman's Inheritance, goes in depth about what that ice does. You're trying to live in ice, cold. The human body, the human animal is a warm-blooded animal. It's supposed to live on the equator. It's supposed to live in the Tropic of Capricorn and Cancer. It's not supposed to live above that, in that going toward the Arctic Circle. I mean, it did because it's an adaptable machine, so it adapts, but it adapts with a cost, with a price, and that price was done. And another thing, and like I said, I always like to give our audience references. There's another piece that was done, too, that was, again, it's a fictional piece, but it was done by an anthropologist, a French anthropologist who believed in that theory. It's called The Quest for Fire. And that's a movie. And The Quest for Fire kind of explains those that were coming out of the icebox of Europe down into the warmer regions and some of the more specific things that they would encounter and go through, even to the point of procreating. ice culture, people appropriated like dogs, because that position was better for cold weather, you know, in colder kind of climate. That movie, Quest for Fire, shows that. It talks about that in that movie, and looking at the behavior. So there's a lot of social history, you know, out of climate. We are products of our environment. And one of the reasons that Europeans are so crazy about dogs is because they had to pattern their life after dogs. And the wolf was the source of everything. The wolf was an invader. He was ferocious. He had to take his food. If somebody had some meat and he didn't have it, he'd go over there and whip, take it, bite him, bite. Same thing the Europeans do. And they pattern their whole ethos from the dog. And people know that. I'm not telling anything new. This is all shrouded in history. There are obviously going to be arguments, disagreeing with it, and that's fine. But I think you, and that's what we do at a think tank. We look at these ideas and we attempt to try to understand them in a certain kind of way. Sister Yan, I didn't leave you out of the conversation, but could you kind of speak to a little bit about that, the fact that we can be evil too sometime, and how do you see that in reference to what we are talking about that was done to us in the transatlantic slave system in that way? Can you kind of just, because I know you are very strong therapy work and psychology, and you've done a lot of reading, you're attempting to try to heal, you know, and we do mean things, now, no doubt about that. How do we need to look at that from a think tank perspective?
Well, for me, human beings obviously are not perfect. We all have our flaws,
right,
you know, and our goodness and our healthy behaviors and unhealthy behaviors. And it's up to each group, whether it's a race or ethnic group or family or whatever, it's up to that group to heal themselves. And I'm standing on that because one of the mistakes that I really believe that we've made and continue to make is trying to be multicultural and, you know, help everybody else to, you know, tell everybody how much we need to hold hands and be brothers and sisters when they don't want to be your brother and sister and they don't want to hold your hand.
Right.
I saw some footage from this civil rights struggle last night, and I saw two pieces where young black men were asking the police who were ready to bash their heads in if they could pray with them. And the police and other white folk, and their response was, "I don't want to pray with you, nigga." You know, and the black person couldn't understand, like, well, I'm talking about prayer. I'm talking about God. And the dude said, "I believe in God, but I don't like niggas. I don't want to be bothered with you." And so a lot of them, whether it's during slavery, before slavery, or now, are very clear that there's contempt against black people. And again, until we face that thing, there are many components to human behaviors, et cetera, but until we as a people, until face that thing, we're going to stay stuck. And I don't want to be stuck anymore.
Right.
Frankly, I'm tired of us being stuck. I'm seeing too much happen. And, you know, I keep saying, at what point are we going to move? I was also thinking about healing. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's just my response to what you said. Because as a matter of fact, in reading the Somme's, you know, writing, Malazoma Somme and his wife, you know, they talk about traditional practices in Africa that were, not safe. They were crappy, you know.
Okay.
So I'm not ever suggesting that Africa, African culture is perfect.
No, by no
means. But we are so much more advanced in terms of our humanity and our spirituality and culture and everything than Europeans. that my belief is that we have to go back to who we are. I want to also speak to healing, because when we think of healing, I think a lot of us think that we would be all better, you know, that we would be without anger, that we'd be at peace and love, you know, and that's just not necessarily the case, because there's just too much from the past and the present that we have to deal with. So since the abuses and the torture never ends, I think it's impossible for us to think that the anger that we feel and whatnot is going to disappear. One of the aspects of healing is that a person actually embraces their anger and stop running away from it.
Okay.
And yeah. Embrace the anger.
We run away a lot, don't we?
Hmm?
I say we do that, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. And so we embrace the anger and realize it's actually not your enemy. That's the European that gave us all these messages that, you know, crying is weak, and if you're angry, something is wrong with you, and, you know, no, these are human emotions that need to be embraced. And when you stop running from a human emotion, embrace it, you can actually redirect it. For instance, when we do damage to each other, to your question, or, you know, when you first asked me the question, the damage we do to each other today, most of that is misdirected anger. You can't, when we see, you know, cops killing and beating and all that stuff, our people, we can't go after those cops. We turn it on each other. It's misdirected anger.
Right, exactly.
So if when we embrace, you know, this anger that is very real and this rage, we can actually redirect it into doing something constructive for ourselves.
Exactly.
So healing doesn't mean you're not going to feel anger and pain and whatnot anymore.
Right.
Because we're still human.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but we can redirect it into to building. Just, you know, to wind this up, our ancestors that began to enter that Jim Crow era and were tortured and lynched and whatnot, they had no doubts about who the enemy was.
Right.
That was very obvious. Yet they still built up their communities.
Mm-hmm.
The anger was there. All that was there, and there was a significant amount of pacification through Christianity, but they still built because they weren't confused
right.
about who the enemy was.
Exactly.
Now we're getting confused with multiculturalism and, you know, multiracial and all this other stuff,
right.
and all these ideas that we think are going to bring humanity together, while Bolsonaro and Trump and the rest of those crazies continue to destroy the whole earth.
Yeah.
So yeah, that I'll finish there.
Well, I appreciate it. I see my brother came on from Montgomery, Alabama. It's we got about a minute and a half left. Is there anything, my brother, you want to say real quickly? 3, 3, 4.
Peace and blessings, Dr. Rogers and Sister Ayan. Just two quick things. One, would you recommend America's Unholy Ghost as a good read? And two, to follow up on Sister Ayan's discussion, are we born traumatized as a people? And I'll just call it a day and catch you next week.
Let me ask, yes, definitely that book. And I can talk about why in another program. Sister Ayan, you want to respond real quickly to what he said?
We suffer generational trauma. So, yes, it's not inherent, but it's inherited. It's passed down.
Okay. All right. Well,
trauma is passed down through DNA, through memory, through feelings, through so much. So, yeah, we can come out traumatized. Yes, we can.
Okay.
Thank
it's
you.
Our closing hour. Thank you so Black much, all of you. We will see you next week right here on the Black Reality. Thank you. Have a good and blessed week.